this poem is about centres around a music class and harmonies. You don't have to know anything about music to understand the poem. It mostly tells the story of two people's decision not to do nothing as evil begins to surround and suffocate them. Their friendship is one assertive action. They trash out doubt with conversation. They have music in common, their worries and lack of power, well, they attack these together. Brash glamour. Where are combats? She has coffee and a scone, while he has coffee, smokes. They might close the centre down. Caffeine sips lift, lowered eyes. Smoke break from class, about harmonies, today in the hall. She offers, it's nice to have something to do. Trapping mindful doubt in headlights of talk, and time that has to be used up anyway. Brazen chat about oneself. Learn to keep quiet. To hear thundered silence of her companion. To console. To be able to console herself when back in the apartment alone.
Well done, thank you, Anisha. And now we have the winner of our 5-word challenge, Connor Prunty. Okay.
That's far. Just going to read someone poems just called The Passion. Very short. It was your stillness that hooked at the bone plates, stalking trundles of knotted sunlight. A locket of old moons burned on your chest, responding to the pulse of strain of an unconscious earth. And still I see you, dimly lit with your arctic flowers, biting the flat star of my mind, as you spilled into the briar of loveless love. And the birds like artists, behind the easel of an unfinished masterpiece, singing with poise in the wet ponderment of moods. Your sorrows came sevenfold, screws teasing on the scaffold of a solitary heart. As the plume of red hurled its hot pangs onto the frame of a nervy fascist, leather-chested, and all our passion perilous against the modesty of mountains, for now we jostle in winds love-strewn. And how you came to be in the supernova of ancient laughter, in this nebula of relics, descending stairwells starless as the cube of your heart held thistles. Now the vault has been split, furrows in the ridge of sky, searching for heaven's mineral as I did in your gaze, that wet ruby, miraculous in all its delirium. And now I rise from the tangles of that watery grave, until pools where your eyes once cooled in their oils, like the adder ascends from the gulch of stillness to confiscate a quaking kingdom. These hands now envelop a cauldron of shadows, and the mind weeps its dream weep, and the fire blisters as everything blisters, thirsting for awe's slow derangement. Yet I could never resuscitate the rhyme that made you immaculate, bound to the fury of an old ghost I retreat, and your ghosts already summoned. You imagined me as your corporal god, and I saw the dragon in your stare, whirring wild-eyed across the fleeting sky.
Thanks, Connor. I know tonight is your first night here. I hope it's not your last. Good going. And now we have Marie Coveney, who has just been shortlisted for
an important prize that I can't remember the name of.
What is it?
Britport.
The Britport.
Yeah.
There are 200 in the shortlist.
You shouldn't have said that at all.
Not This is a poem about, well, it's in response to it's in response to a painting, quite an abstract painting of two lovers in a studio, and one presumably being the model, so it's in the voice of the model. Afternoon in the studio, and pumps our shoes for the men here. After the painting, a new Louboutin pumps by Cecily Brown. I was naked but for the shoes. He grabbed my left buttock, hoisted me on his hip. Our flesh snapped and jiggled. He nibbled the lobe of my ear. Blobs of paint gleamed on tabletops. I didn't care that my snakeskin toe butted a congealed blob of alizarin, rhythmically releasing the ooze. Canvases faced the walls as we cavorted into corners. On the floor, oil of spiked lavender and linseed mingled an olfactory orgy. Beyond the window, the thrilling of cicadas fell away to a spent note. As we settled on the chaise lounge, he brought my Louboutin pump to his nose, inhaling deeply.
Following Marie, we have Jill Sweeney.
This is a first part of an essay. It's in six parts. I'm not going to read all six tonight. You'll be relieved to hear. I'm just going to read the first part. And the essay is entitled On Being 23. And it's subtitled Reuben. Some years after leaving the university, I ran into Reuben again, and I must say, I hardly recognized him. We were just teenagers when we first met, of course, but he looked dissipated, unconscionably so. When I commented on this, he said, well, I am 31, you know, as if this made everything all right. We chatted about the good old days, but when I left Reuben, I felt anything but good. Several years later, I ran into him again, only to find that he was no longer even 31. Now it seemed he was something like 37, or 42 maybe. I can't quite remember. I've never had much of a head for numbers. To be honest, only one number interests me now. What is to become of us if we are to be chopping and changing like Henry VIII with every passing year? No wonder faith and integrity are on the decline. People are drifting along from year to year like seaweed on the tide. If we keep letting ourselves go with every birthday that flows in and out, where will it all end? One must put one's foot down. The whole thing came to a head when I met Reuben in the street again, just 6 months ago. The situation was even worse now, far worse. The minute I saw him, I knew there was little hope. He had very little hair, a mole on his cheek, and crow's feet around his eyes. It stuck me up, I can tell you. Now, loyalty forbids me to mention a drooping eyelid, missing teeth, and a limp, but I must confess that I began to wonder if the person in front of me could really be Reuben at all. If it was Reuben, and somehow I feel it was, I have to say that he had let himself go. The youthful spirit which characterized him when we were students was gone. The light-hearted youth who had waltzed with me down Grafton Street years before, clutching a pint glass of Guinness in one hand and the other over my shoulder, was nowhere to be seen. Reuben the Wild, who had raved around dance hall floors with me years before, the long-haired Viking-like youth who had serenaded startled teenage girls in the streets of Dublin in the small hours of the morning, had faded like a shade into the evening of life. In his place was nothing but a straggle of seaweed tossed aside by the terrible tide of time. I didn't stay talking too long with Reuben on this last occasion. I had no interest. After no more than a few minutes, I shook his hand, wished him well, and said goodbye. I am not optimistic about the road ahead for him. Reuben, alas, has not discovered his true age. The poor man has allowed himself to be surrounded by propagandists, bombarding him with lies, brainwashing about what age he is. He has failed utterly to keep those barbarians and their slanderous allegations outside the gates. It is time, ladies and gentlemen, that someone spoke up and told the truth, and I am quite happy to be the one. In fact, I shall relish it. Age is a dangerous thing. It is the ague with you missing. And pretty soon, you will be missing too, completely. You'll be dead if you don't take things in hand. The ague, the dictionary informs us, is a feverish condition involving alternating hot, cold, and sweating stages. Ring a bell? It is certainly a neat description of the effect of the approach of my birthday used to have on me. Not anymore, of course. I dealt with that matter some time ago. Age is quite simply a sickness which eventually leads to death. Chronology is the most chronic condition facing humanity. And what's more, it's contagious. You must keep clear of people who think they are old for fear they drag you down with them. Age is the enemy, make no mistake, and it keeps moving all the time to avoid the slings and arrows. The years sneak in, the years dodge out, the numbers mount. Figures, if not kept in check, accumulate against you like mice in the kitchen or bats in the belfry. Every time people try to sling your numerical age at you, therefore, you must strike at it like it was a wasp or mosquito, like you were batting for your country. You must knock every number thrown at you for six or seven if necessary. If you want to remain youthful and happy, you simply must know your correct age and stamp out all other impostors. Crunch that number, or it'll crunch you. Stamp it underfoot like it was a slug or a snail. The worst thing you could do is to become complacent, to ignore the thing and hope it will go away. That's the problem with modern life. We are so distracted by things we keep taking our eye off the ball. And we are misled by research. We think there is nothing to worry about anymore. The scientists keep telling us that statistically we are all likely to live longer lives than our forebears. But what is the use of this if you're old? Beware of propaganda. Remember, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. The truth is that in this 21st century, as mankind reaches the age of maturity, no real progress has been made. What's the point in being alive if you're 97 or 108? The scientists just don't get it. People are being sucked down into the quicksand of age, just like they have always been down through the centuries. The scientists are whistling past the graveyard. The priests are praying inside the graveyard, but no one's doing anything about the problem. Age is killing people every day. It's claiming more people than mumps, measles, leprosy, the plague, drink driving, potholes, politicians, bad poetry, the news, incompetent doctors, the sight of medical bills and letters from the Inland Revenue all put together. People are going down like tenpins, and you will go down too if you don't get your act and your age together. If you don't learn to act your true age, your age will start acting up. And you needn't be at all surprised if one day it puts you out of action completely.
Thank you.
I don't know, there's none of us getting younger anyway. And the alternative, I don't know, I prefer to get old myself. Next we have Mary O'Connor. Slight bad, Mary. Slight bad. It's not so bad.
Way back in January, I heard on the news that reading poetry was very good for the brain. So I wrote this. It's called Poetry, Please. If you're feeling lost or lonely, got the January blues, someone's thought of a solution. I just heard it on the news. All those self-help books you've paid for, or else borrowed on the sly, are considered less than useless by some academic guy. Maureen Gaffney's book on wisdom has been flying off the shelves, as so many wish to flourish and express their inner selves. But the latest innovation that some scientists revealed is that poetry has powers that were hitherto concealed. A recipe to raise the mood, a challenge for the mind, would be reading or reciting poems, the best that you can find. Mix in sonnets, haiku, ballads, all you need is half a cup. Leave them browning in the oven. When they're done, just take them up. When you focus your attention to unravel cryptic lines, it triggers countless neurons to fire off at different times. Sample Eliot or Healy, Ezra Pound or Sylvia Plath. The effect becomes electric, and your brain gets charged by that, becomes flooded with endorphins. All your dwindling hopes revive. Reading poetry is the answer. Makes it worthwhile staying alive.
Did you hear that, Dildo? I hope you're listening. And next we have another newcomer, Alan O'Gorman.
This is just a short little scene. Basically, I was reading an article there lately and some examples of sex scenes from literature, and they were awful. So I said I'd give my hand in, you know, deep, meaningful, and honest account of the act of lovemaking. And it's very serious, by the way. How to write a sex scene. From the look in her eyes and the pressing together of her big, flabby knees, I knew she was keen for it. She didn't have to say anything. In fact, she bit her lower lip, signalling that she was ready. It had been coming a long time. I took her head in my hands, caressing her thick, blonde hair, like patting a fine-coated golden retriever. Good girl, I thought. Who's a good girl, I said aloud. I am, she replied. I kissed her mouth and buried my tongue inside like a drill, boring for oil. But instead I struck something much sweeter. Her saliva flooded into my mouth, and it tasted like forbidden honey, like manna to the Jews wandering through that desert all those years. I took a step back then, and grabbing her shirt with two hands, ripped it open like a much-anticipated Christmas present, sending the buttons bouncing and scattering all over the wooden floor. This show of raw manly strength only increased her need to have me inside her now. Slipping the remaining fragments of her shirt off with ease, I did her bra with one hand, two fingers to be precise. And once it fell to the floor like a fallen log, it was these two exact fingers which dropped between her legs, ascending up her skirt, bypassing her moist knickers, and lodging themselves firmly inside her pulsating satchel. With my thumb, I kept the knickers at bay. She moaned while I kissed her bullet-like nipples and stuck the index finger of my spare hand in her right ear, rubbing the lobe between my middle finger and thumb. I continued pumping the other two fingers like a child poking at a tub of Play-Doh. She was in convulsions. I took the hand from her ear and ran it down her thick neck and continued down to her plump belly, which I squeezed tight until I found her ribs. These I pressed firmly and her legs tightened around me. I kissed her enormous breast for some time, my head being in there so long now that the abundance of skin and flab had caused me to sweat uncontrollably, like a dyslexic on countdown. I shook my head from side to side, giving her a good dousing. She said my name. Oh, Roderick. Yes, I said, looking up at her. You sure know how to make a girl squirm. I took that as a compliment and began to work my way down, pulling her skirt off and flinging her over my head. It crashed into something behind me with a loud thud, but I was too excited to care. Removing my hand from deep within her, my wrist had long gone dead. I slipped off her underwear and stretched them out before me. They were big enough to wrap around a spruce tree. This only enticed me further. I lifted up her massive legs and placed them around my shoulders, the weight forcing me down, level with her treasure chest. I approached her with my face, blindly, like a ship in the night whose sails are caught up in a gale, hurtling towards her with my tongue. The taste struck the palate wonderfully, like a salmon sandwich on a summer's day. I bobbed my head forwards and back and got so caught up in the motion. It was like a chubby toddler bouncing endlessly on a trampoline, her being the mat, my head the toddler. Finally, I knew it was time. I stood before her, erect, my penis a proud cucumber, only not green and cold, pink and steaming hot, more like a cooked parsnip, I suppose. Angelina, I said. Yes, she groaned. Will you take me to be your lawfully wedded husband? I do, she said. And with that, I entered her forcefully. We kissed again, now drenched in sweat and other bodily fluids. She reached her tongue down my throat, and although I felt I might choke, it was like she was breathing a new life into me. I felt happy. I pounded away while she remained seated on the green felt of her father's poker table. And when I came, I released everything inside of her. My semen, yes, but also my deepest desires, my innermost secrets, and you, my son. So you see, boy, that is how I proposed to your mother, and how you were brought into this world. Aren't you glad you asked? Incidentally, it's also where Grandma's poker table got that nasty stain from.
I quite like to have a video camera to record all the facial expressions around the room for that one. 50 Shades of Grey, you've got nothing on your back. Nothing, I tell you. There's only one man that can save the day now. Cal Doyle. Well now.
I composed this poem in my head about 3 years ago while I was fucking the same woman. The poem is called "I Can't Believe You're Marrying Him." Look, I know with his money, career, and pants that this guy is clearly ticking a lot of your wants. But you're here, arched back and on your knees, and I am the one who is ticking your need.
Okay, so we're in the same ballpark area. Maybe you, Tom McCarthy, can.
Go ahead, Rosie. Yeah, run away.
Something more enigmatic from Gerrit Achterberg, as translated by Michael O'Loughlin. Quantity. You no longer lie so compact. The trains travel around you, round in you, with a wound in you. Death has insufficient stone. The stone has insufficient death. For yourself, you've become too great. For yourself, you've become too many. What you once possessed as singular, I can count now, one by one, light years all around me.
I don't need to say anything after that. It's lovely. And next we have Jack Corbett.
So I have absolutely no intention of reading anything. And then I heard Michael's poem about his grandmother, and I was going to subject you to my poem about my grandmother. And I said that doesn't mean more said you that said nothing. So instead I'm going to read a piece called On Recollections in Small Hours. It's about growing up and about growing old and about moving on. I have no idea what it was that I caught the scent of around 3 o'clock this morning in this bohemian coffee place that's open in the city. For whatever reason, always one to leave me prying at reasons, it threw me back into your flat in Edinburgh with its Victorian window open to the spring and the taste of the sweet raspberry wine that your grandfather made on your breath as we made love. And it was the same as when I first smelled earthy marijuana and was back in the kitchen I grew up in, with my parents' friends laughing around the plain hardwood table. My mother was still a saint. and I was held in rapture by the crisp night air that blew in through the patio door, tasting the way I knew adulthood must. I watched the candles dancing from the cool stone floor, and the night grew old with grace.
Thank you, Jack. I hope you come again. All this talk about getting old, it's terrible. Anyway, well, I suppose. Next we have Cedric.
That one's called The Call. It had been one of these days, fending off my bullies. My parents had been convinced that I was cut for school life, and like a confirmation, the world seemed to want a piece of me. Luckily enough, the day ended before anyone succeeded. But I had enough of a daily fight. A one-man army never wins battles against 1,000. They can only make it 10. So I retreated, dodged unwelcome questions while ascending to my room. Once the door closed, fallen through my careless push, I sunk, gave in to the loneliness. And then I heard a stick. Why don't you close your eyes? Well, why not? There was nothing else I wanted to do. So I did. I held nothing back, putting out every spark of a thought. The voice again sounded. Just sit here, let them go. So I did again. I was now alone, in the dark of my mind. Nothing existed anymore. At least it was better than outside of it. Where are you? He asked. And then the darkness turned white. With my eye, I could see myself in an undefined space. The light was everywhere, and it spoke. Don't you know where I am? Nagging and mocking me. This was when I realized I was everywhere. This boundless bubble wasn't mine, but I was at the center of it, at its very core. So I started to look for the voice. In a gaze, I was projecting myself across the immaculate land, from which spawned objects just as white as the rat in my wake. Furniture, rooms, walls, flowers, bushes, trees, all of it was me. The search went on, but I could not sense it anywhere. When I looked back at myself, I could barely see me, for I was everywhere, alive and populous. The voice finally returned. It was loud, grave, and omnipresent. Maybe next time. Its tone was ominous. The euphoria ended in a pop. My heart settled down, and I opened my eyes. I was addicted to the search, and I knew I would have to pay to get my fix. My time awake would have to be my curse. My mother called from the ground floor. Time to check these homework I had not done yet. Here was my first payment.
Thanks very much, Cedric. And finally, on the open mic, we have Christy Parker.
All right. Two minds will have to read a deep, sensitive poem that could change everyone's life, or I'll just go for the fucking rule band.
What do you think?
Sensitive one?
I don't have one that's both rude and sensitive. I go for the sensitive one, so. It's my own book, Don't Step Into Poems, which is probably a little one around the edge, because I've been reading it for the last 9 years, but however, some of you will probably not have heard this before. It's about a story about London, okay, where I lived for a long time, and it's called She Won't Do. You wanted the sensitive one, so you're going to get it. She burnt my hand with cigarette ash. She said her cousin was in the clash. She lent me money to buy some hash. I said I need a place to crash. The night we met in London town. She said she wanted to sing in a band, but she had a child that had been unplanned. And I was lost in no woman land the night she took my hand in sweet, sweet London town. She stuck her fag out on the floor before we reached the pub's front door. The bouncer whistled and she swore. I knew that there was more in store that night in London town. Out in the cool north London air, the neon lights danced on her hair. There were whores and winos there to spare. It began to rain, but we didn't care in easy London town. She gave a beggar 50 pence. Life, she said, does not make sense when all your best days are past tense. Her cat was waiting by the fence for us in London town. She had sent her son to see his dad. I miss him, she said, he's a lovely lad. And I heard her say, but tonight I'm glad because of the good time that I've had out in London town. Everything was going fine. We smoked a joint, we drank some wine. She moved her lips closer to mine. And in the morning we were lying in our bed in London town. It said 10:30 on the clock when we heard a policeman's knock. His voice delivered a cruel shock. A son was taken from the lock in cold, grey London town. His dad expressed his disbelief the moment he'd lost him was so grief. Fate, he said, is just a thief that is sentenced to meet to a lifetime's grief in lonely London town. Forever in my life, she said, it would haunt me in my head that we were sleeping in my bed when they pulled my only child out dead in cruel, cruel London town. I met her only once again. Her eyes were empty but for pain. She was standing in the rain and I watched her leaving on a train out of London town. Okay? Okay, I think the guy who wants to play has not appeared yet, so I'll chance the rude one, alright?
Right.
It's a poem about sex. Gay sex.
Another one.
Gay sex. In public, on the street. A dog named Jack and a dog named Jeff, sorry about that, folks, met on the street one day. Says Jack to Jeff, can I have a sniff? Says Jeff, sure, by the way. So Jack, when he snout, checked the other dog out in the area under his belly, and the more that he moved his cold nose about, the more Jeff's legs turned to jelly. Now it's fair to confide that once into his stride, Jack undertook the occasional lick, and Jeff's whimpering cries very clearly imply this was better than chasing a stick. Then quietly Jack raised one leg in the air, took up a position behind, to his friend he declared on that thoroughfare, it's my birthday today, which mind? You only asked for the sniff, said the good-natured Jiff. You never said nothing about humping. But the sniff was terrific, and seeing as you're stiff, well, I'll give you 3 minutes of pumping. That they suffered no nerves, was plain to observe, but from the two tails merrily wagging, and passers-by passing by had to sidestep and swerve around the two happy dogs shagging. By being so indiscreet around people's feet in pursuit of their sex-driven action, they caused shoppers to stop on their tracks in the street and take note of this frantic distraction. Soon a drunken old dog rushed out of a pub. Boy, Jesus, said he, that's what this is. I was leaving that pub to purchase some grub, but I think I'll go home to the missus. A priest cycling past gave an audible gasp as he rounded the corner upon them. It's all right, Father White, the man with a rasp. There's no fear he's using a condom. Then a young girl in love cried, heavens above, Lord God, I'd be ever so grateful. If only my bloke was as good with his stroke, I swear to him I'd even stay faithful. And the young little lad in the arms of his dad became immediately funny. To the joy of the crowd, he shouted out loud, look, Daddy, it's like you and Mummy. 3 minutes went by, and our cool birthday boy made one last big push of his luck. And that's probably why, at the end of his joy, to his horror, he found he was stuck. The more that he tried to become untied, the more he stayed stuck on the end. Oh, that's great, said his mate in sarcastic aside, now you're my very close friend.
They wriggled and squiggled while half the town giggled, but they stayed caught by that cruel erection. And in the middle of the jiggle, Jack found he'd so wriggled that he faced in the opposite direction. For 2 cursed hours, they were stuck on the spot, with the bystanders pointing and jeering, like a moth with 2 heads that have fled were it not for problems to do with the steering. Then a young man suggested, and it went uncontested, that the doggies be given some drink. He said, I believe, and my wife would agree, that booze causes the watsit to shrink. So after much whiskey, with the dogs far from frisky, separation was gentle and quick. But beware of the danger when you meet with a stranger and decide to have sex in a jiff. Thank you.